This morning we'll be in chapter 33 of Genesis. Not a very long chapter, but there's some good information here for us. So it'll be chapter 33, we'll start verse 1. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children into Leah, into Rachel, and unto the two handmaids. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph the hindermost. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are those with thee?" And he said, "The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." Then the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. And he said, "What meanest thou by all this drove which I met?" And he said, These are to find grace in the sight of my Lord." And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep that you hast unto yourself." And Jacob said, "Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in your sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and you was pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, thy blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And he urged him, and he took it. And he said, "Let us take our journey, and let us go, and I will go before you." And he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are tender, and the flocks and herds with young are with me. And if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly according as the cattle that goes before me, and the children be able to endure until I come to my Lord and to Zaire." And Esau said, "Let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me." And he said, "What need is it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Zaire. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him a house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it Elohi Israel. Some of those names are tongue twisters. Okay, let's go back and see what's going on in Jacob's life. Or what should I say, what's going on in whose life? Our lives. And it starts off again in 33, and Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, with him 400 men. What do you think is going on in his life right at this present? He just had a conversation experience with God. Now here's the thing. Don't let it think for a moment that just as soon as God touched the hollow of his thigh and all this happened, immediately he lifted up his eyes and saw. There could have been days or weeks in here. That's not the point. The next thing that's going to happen in his life after you have an experience is there has to be a time of digesting what you've experienced. Does that make sense? Because you'd be overwhelmed if the stuff, just like Bob said earlier, all this information coming all at one time, sometimes overwhelming. It's just a constant flow of it. So God gives you the grace to grasp and to digest what he's given to you so you won't overeat and vomit up the good word you found. So right now, he's lifted up his eyes, and he looked, and behold, he saw Esau coming, and 400 men with him. And the first thing he did was what? Huh? What did he do? Well, we know there was something else he did that's not written down here. Fear got all over him. He saw Esau coming with 400 men, and the first thing he thought, he's coming to get even. You know why? Because Jacob still has guilt and condemnation in his mind. And see, we can be sons of God and still have guilt and condemnation because of something out of our past. And there was something called the cross, and there was something shed on that cross called blood that is supposed to remove all the effects of the past. All guilt and condemnation was washed away at the cross when he shed his blood. Do you realize that? So whatever you've done in your life, you should not carry guilt and condemnation for it. It was part of the experience that God has set up for you to experience to bring you to maturity. Well, what about the bad things I did? What about them? David cried out in his heart in the Psalms, I was shaped in my sins and iniquities. Hello, you are too. If we don't make mistakes, if we don't do something wrong, we will never learn. Isn't that correct? Okay. So Jacob is still holding on. Now, God's not telling you you're supposed to hold on to the past. He's saying, even though you're a son of God, your carnal mind's going to be there aggravating you and tormenting you over that thing. And if you believe me, the exact opposite of fear is what? Faith. The exact opposite of faith is fear. So though he has some faith that God has given him, he's still trying to hold on to that carnal side. And the book says in James what? That a double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. So he's going to make a lot of decisions that are not correct because he's trying to hold on to two ways of thinking. Is that right? If you make two ways of thinking in your mind, today, because we're meeting in our fellowship, I can think godly things, and then when we leave here today, I can go back and think worldly again. That sounds like two ways of thinking. Sounds like religion. See? We got to be what we say we are. Whatever we are today, we should be tomorrow. Whatever we are or however we act today should be the same every day. Isn't that right? If I come to church and act really good, and out there in the world I don't act that way, you know what that makes me? A hypocrite. See? And it's the same thing in dress. I see people, they come to church and they dress up real fancy. Big hats and all this big flowing jewelry and everything. And guess what? If you wear it all the time, that's okay. But if you do it just because you come to church on Sunday morning, that's hypocritical. You're putting on a fashion show. It's not about a fashion show. It's not about the clothes you wear. I'm a blue jeans guy and only half a pair in the summertime. Okay. And that's who I am. So when, guess what, when that's over with, if I go put a suit on to come out here to talk to you about God, to have a relationship, then I'm a hypocrite. Okay. I'm not a hypocrite. I'm just who I am. And that's the way you should be. God didn't tell you. I had a conversation with a Baptist minister one time, and he said, well, the Bible says that you've got to wear your best clothes to church on Sunday. And I said, chapter and verse. Where's it at? It ain't in there. Come on. It's not there. It's something someone made up. It's a tradition. It's culture. It has nothing to do. Because I guarantee you, when Jesus was preaching, he was walking around with sheep doo-doo all over him when he was walking in camel doo-doo. Come on. He was doing this. You think he had a whole wardrobe of clothes and someone doing makeup for him before he preached? He had one set of clothes and he wore them. They wore them back then until they fell off of him. That's exactly what they're doing. That's the whole thing. Everybody failed to look at the thing. We got to understand what's going on here. We got to get rid of this fear in our mind. What am I allowed to be afraid of? I should be afraid of nothing. If God chooses this day for you to die, what are you going to do about it? All the medical people in the world can't stop it, can they? And that's where guilt and condemnation comes again, because we go to a doctor and have surgeries and have medication given to us. There's people that condemn you for that. Why? It's here. Didn't the scripture say that all things are lawful? Come on. Let no man judge you for meat, drink, respect of new moons, holidays, Sabbaths, anything else. It's you. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. That's what it's all about. Anyway, he divided the children to Leah and to Rachel and to the two handmaids. But then he tells you what he did with them. He put the handmaids in front. Why? They were the least important to him. And then he put put Leah out there and her children. And then he puts Rachel and Joseph. Why? Because Joseph is what? He's the one that's called. He's his special son. He figures this is his last son. You know what? It's not. He just thinks it is. And he put Joseph last. Why was he put him in that order? Well, for safety reasons. if the 400 men going to come and attack, they're going to get the first ones they come to and give the rest time to scatter. See? A chance of them possibly escaping. And when he did this, then Jacob finally takes a little responsibility. I see him now that he has had his walk changed. He doesn't walk like the natural man Jacob anymore, does he? He's got a slight limp, slowed him down. Like we said a while ago, slowing down. He slowed him down. And now I see him become the shepherd he really was. In the natural, he was a shepherd over all the flocks of Laban. But in the spiritual, now I see him becoming a shepherd because now his family has become important to him. Now I see him saying, y'all get back here, but I'm going to go up front and lead you as a shepherd should. Not walk in the back and let all the sheep be sacrificed and slaughtered so he can survive. He's going to take the brunt of everything now. I see him starting to take his position as a true man of God. And he bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came to his brother. What does 7 represent? Completeness. It also represents a covenant. And he was trying to present himself as a covenant person to his brother. He was looking for forgiveness from his brother because he knew he had done his brother wrong. Right? And that was the whole basis of his fear. And he knew that Esau was coming to get him in his mind. He knew that Esau had made the statement that once Dad's gone, I'm going to get him. I'm going to get him. But now when he did this, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. You know, what we fail to realize sometimes is God lets things go on in their life. And, you know, people have ideas in their mind. And those cherubim in our mind build things up for us. They create problems. Now, if God is in control of all things, and I say that very facetiously if I say if, God being in control of all things, if something terrible happened with Jacob and Esau, and they both were separated, not because of what they really thought, but it's what they thought each other thought. The cherubim were doing their work, and they kept them separated. But God being in control of all things was also in control of Esau's thoughts. So those fleshly thoughts that come in Esau's mind and in our minds also, he represents our minds. Guess what? When that comes in mind, who's in control of it? God's in control of it. So when these things happen, guess what? God has orchestrated all of this. And so if I respond to the fear, do you think there's ever going to be a reconciliation? To have reconciliation, there has to be a total ejection of all fears. Do you hear me? To be a person of reconciliation, I can have no condemnation, no guilt, no fear, no retaliation. It's okay whatever God does. You have something in there blocking that line of communications, that free flow with the Spirit of God. Anytime I've got this stuff, it slows it down. So I'm just saying, we have to let it all go. I had a gentleman come to my house yesterday that hasn't been in my house in over 25 years. And there was things just so parallel with what's going on here. Yeah. He gives me a call. And he shows up here and spent a little time here, and he had to go someplace else. But, you know, it was a shock. And when he left, you know what he said? Come and see me. The man hadn't spoken to me in over 25 years. And he said, come and see me. I said, I will. He said, yeah, right. I said, no, me and my wife will come and visit you. It's a several hours drive, but we'll go visit him. I mean, this man was a big part of my life in my younger years. And I don't even know why he walked away from me. He wouldn't even tell me what's wrong. Would never speak to me again over 25 years. But see, I had to put that aside. Even if I did do something wrong, it was necessary for that separation. And you know what? With Jacob and Esau, the separation, if they had been together all their life, they would probably never could have got the relationship that they're going to get now. No way of reconciling if there's a separation. So if you are a person of reconciliation in your heart, if you have that heart of God in you to reconcile, and you live that reconciliation, you know what's going to happen sooner or later? To everyone that's walked out of your life, every one of them will return to your life. That's God. And that is not their doings, and that's not your doing. If it's God's heart controlling you and controlling everyone else, they'll all come back once you have changed to where God wants you changed. So don't be looking at them doing something bad to you. You know what my question in my mind has always been about relationships like that and with this gentleman? Why? What's the purpose of it? I've never been upset. I've been hurt. And if I said I wasn't hurt, I'd be lying, because this man was in my life for 25 years and then walked away for 25 years. You know, that hurts. But I didn't get mad at it. And that's only because God had controlled my heart, because I should have been bitter by standards of the world. But all I want to know is why. What's the purpose of it? I understand more now than if he'd have probably told me why. And someday he'll probably tell me why. And when he does, it really won't make any difference, will it? Because the reconciliation has already began. It was in me and it didn't make any difference, you know. And that's the thing. There's other people in my life that's walked away. And I have no idea why, because I didn't do anything. Or if I did do anything, it was beyond my control anyway. But I'm not in condemnation and guilt about anything I've done. But I know sooner or later they're going to come back. And it's just that there's hurt there at one time. But now that there's not even hurt, it's okay, because I understand that God did it for who? For me. He done it for me. He done it to bring me to perfection so that I could express him to the rest of the hurting and dying world. See, I don't feel sorry for myself because I get shorted something. Or my friends leave, you know, our so-called friends leave. Man, this has given me an opportunity to share the love of God and to experience it and to show it, not just talk about it, but to show it. How much better could it be? I don't know anything better. I mean, I can't think of anything better. But now they have this intimate relationship. They're coming back together. And Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children and said, "Who are these with you?" And he said, "The children which Elohim has graciously or bestowed upon me, on your servant." And then the handmaidens came near, and they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near. And Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed themselves, all saying that they were covenant and showing honor and respect unto Esau. And I'm sure they all know about it. I'm sure Jacob told them, said, "Now, you know, we're going back over here on this journey. God said to go back to my land of nativity, to back to my family." And he said, "I done the cat wrong. I done Esau wrong. And, you know, he should have had the birthright. He should have had everything, but I conned him out of it." And so he knew, and they all knew, that this was a real serious time in this confrontation. Because their mind's saying, you know, we may die today. But you know what? They don't understand God. Life has nothing to do with living a natural life or dying. It's something spiritual. And he said, "What do you mean by all this company or body of people which I met?" Which the word "drove" there should be a company or body of people. "What do you mean by all these people? Why did you set all these people out here in this order?" What did he say? "These are to find grace," or literally favor, "in the sight of my Lord." He said, "I want you to see how much I've increased." You think that meant anything to Esau? What we possess, how many cars we have, how many camels, cows, goats, chickens, pigs, donkeys, I don't care what you have, how much grass you got, how many trees you got, it doesn't mean anything. In God's kingdom, in our family, in God's family, that's not important. Whether you have or have not has nothing to do with it. It's what do you think in your mind. Is your mind the mind of God or not? That's all it's about. And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have to yourself. I don't need your stuff. I got more than you could ever think of." And see, it doesn't make any difference whether he had it or not. It still didn't impress him, did it? And Jacob thought, "Man, I got a bunch of stuff here now. Esau's going to be impressed with it." And guess what he said? "I don't need your stuff." Esau, because God had dealt with him also, just because you don't see Esau's life in writing does not mean that God wasn't dealing with his life at the same time he is dealing with Jacob. And you know what? Esau shows a more godly thing than Jacob does. Because he never come with any manipulation, control, trying to change situations. He just come and run and grab his brother and said, my God, you're back. He thought he was dead someplace, I'm sure. And see, there's the man that come and showed more of God's love and heart than Jacob himself, because God had dealt with him in obscurity. Guarantee it did. See, here's the thing. God takes and shows you that Jacob gets dealt with a certain way. But he didn't say he wasn't dealing with Esau. He was dealing with Esau. And see, a lot of times God takes people, the most insignificant little people, to the world and to the church world. Just because you don't have a big marquee and a 300-foot cross in front of your church and stained glass windows and padded pews, you're not important. But see, that's not God, because he's no respecter of persons. He's not a respecter of possessions either. It's all about your heart. And you know what? It's not even what you do in your heart. It's what he has chosen before the foundation of the world. He chose you in him. It's not up to you about, I'm a good guy because God chose me. No, he probably chose you because you was rotten. And he wanted to fix you and show you how big a mess you was and show you how much work I can do, how much miracle I have to take on you. And he probably about used up his miracles on me to get me straightened up. So, you know, got nothing to crow about, have we? Got no way of being prideful in this thing, because God is the author of all things. Got nothing to crow about. Okay. And Jacob said, no. Well, he should say, it says nay, but he should say no. And the words, I pray thee, shouldn't even be there. He says, no. If now I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present or my gift at my hand. Because therefore, or rightly or correctly, I have seen your face. Look what he says. I have seen your face as what? As though I've seen the face of God. And you was pleased with me. See, here is Jacob realizing that God also was in his brother. Just because he wasn't in the same place I was, he wasn't worshiping at the same church, he wasn't bowing down the same way, wasn't wearing the same collar robe, whatever, he realized, I see God in my brother. Why wouldn't he see God in his brother? His brother was acting more godly than he was. And yeah, but Jacob was chosen. But you know what? It didn't say Esau wasn't chosen for his job. See, just because it's not written doesn't mean it's not so. Doesn't the book say that everything was written down, the world couldn't contain it? Just the things that Jesus did? Do you think this book is a complete history of everything? It's just an outline. It's just an outline to show you something, to show you some pattern. But if you don't expand your mind and see the other side of the coin, guess what? You're going to miss the point. Jacob realized, my brother's been more godly about this thing than I have. Because you know what? If Jacob had been in the number one slot all the time, and Esau had conned him, I bet you Jacob would have killed him. And see, that's the way most Christians are. I'm a Christian now. I got a right to kill you because it's my right, and God will support me. And you see two armies warring against each other, both of them praying, God, help me kill the rest of them. I don't see God in that. I don't see God in these sport teams. They all get out there and pray, God bless us, while we go out there and knock their heads off. I don't see God in that, see? That's all carnality and all flesh. And the church world says, oh, isn't that wonderful? They're talking about God. And yeah, you don't want to get the rest of the words they said in the game either. Because they get them little things, their little parabolic things, pick up the sound and they hear what they're saying out there, and you'll think God was out on the field the way they're talking. You get that later. He said this. He said, I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God. And guess what he said? And he was pleased with me. You know what? There's a great revelation in that. When you can see that God is pleased with you, what's it going to bring to your life when you know God's pleased with you? Peace. And didn't he say, my peace I leave unto you? Well, you got to pick it up. You got to see something. You got to see that God is pleased with you. Do you think that Judas Iscariot, God was displeased with him? He did what he was supposed to do. How can you be upset with someone if they do what you ask them to do? Somebody had to do it. The scripture had to be fulfilled. Why should you be upset with Pharaoh? God hardened his heart. He did exactly what God wanted. He pushed him right into the realm. Let people alone. Quit trying to judge everybody. Quit trying to put a label on somebody. Quit trying to wear a hat to identify yourself as being something better than someone else. Just be who you are, a child of God, period. And he said, take now, that pray thee thing should be now. Take now my blessing that I brought you, or in the word blessing, that should be my gift that I brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have what? The word enough is the Hebrew word kol. Does anybody know what it means? K-O-L-E or K-O-W-L. Huh? It means all. Absolutely. What he's saying is that I have all that I need. He said, take what you, this here. Don't. He said, take this blessing because God has dealt gracious with me and I have all that I need. Okay? And he urged him and he did what? No, the word isn't took. Now see, there's the thing people don't understand. It is critical in these words. These words are critical in your understanding. It said he took it. If I walk over and take something, it's not the same as receiving it. Didn't it say in Hebrews 7 that the old priesthood took, but the Melchizedek priesthood received? Now tell me it's not important on that word. It's important. And that's exactly what he's saying here. He's saying, you're part of the Melchizedek priesthood, and we receive. We don't take anything. Hear that? Don't tell me these words don't mean something. It says every jot and tittle has a meaning. Don't change that. But see, even in this King James translation, there's many, many errors. They took liberty with language and changed things and put their own thoughts in it. All I'm trying to do is show you what it says. Take out the stuff, you know, and see what it really says. But we got to watch these with the language of these words. And he said, who's he? Come on, verse 13. No. I mean, excuse me, 12, verse 12. And he said, let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go before you. Who said that? It's Esau. Esau. And Esau said, let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go in front of you. I'll go first. Who's doing the godly thing here, huh? Flesh man's going first. You can bet on that. And he said to him, and this he here is who? Jacob. And Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are what? Not tender, but weak. And the flocks and herds with young are with me. And if men should overdrive them, how many days? Guess what? See, most people won't pay attention to that little statement. How many days are there? If someone overdrives you one day, what will happen to the flock? If I'm meant to be in the Passover experience day one, guess what? Don't overdrive me into Pentecost because I will die. If I'm meant to be in Pentecost, don't overdrive me into Tabernacles because I will die. God has placed us in the body where it pleases him. It's not about us trying to make everybody fit into one mold. It's about everybody finding the niche that God has chosen for you. Your cleft in the rock. When you come to the place you're supposed to be in God, you will be the first to know it. You don't go to a preacher and say, should I be in this church or should I be in that church? You'll know when you're in the right place. Do you know when you're home in your natural? When you walk, how do you feel when you walk in your home? You've been away for a while. Lord, you've been away. What does it feel like when you walk home? I'm here. Did anybody have to tell you you was home? It's the same thing when you walk into the Spirit of God and you come to the place you're supposed to be in the Spirit. There's going to be peace in your life. You're going to be calm and you're going to know that this is the place. And it does not mean that you will not have any turmoil. True peace is when you have peace in the midst of the storm, not when all the storms have been removed. Pay attention to this. When you come to the place in God, you will know it. You will no longer feel the pressures of condemnation and guilt and fear. You will feel very relaxed, but yet even when the storm's blowing, it won't bother you. You'll just be at peace. Let my Lord, the word let shouldn't even be there. My Lord now pass over before your servant, and I will lead on gently, not softly, according to the cattle that goes with me, before me, and the children accordingly, until I come to my Lord to Seir. What's Seir mean? Hairy, shaggy, or rough? He said, we're going on to that rough place. Don't you know when he's going back into that place, we're going to meet you in that rough place. When it's going to be rough when the spirit and the soul, the spirit and the flesh have to meet together, and there's only one going to come out of that battle. Is that right? Only one's coming out of that one. And Esau said, let me now leave some of the folk that are with me with you. And he said, what need is it? Let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. What's he really saying? He said, let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. He's saying basically that. He's saying, if I have found favor in your eyes, trust me, I'll take care of it. It's also the spirit man saying, I don't need the flesh's help. Do we? I don't need no fleshly help, do you? I mean, in the walk with God, do I need a fleshly help? Nope, don't need it. I don't need someone come and give me fleshly ideas. I need the truth, don't I? I need the truth above everything else. So that's the thing he's trying to convey here. You need to trust me. If I found favor in your eyes, then you got to trust me. I don't need your help. And you could say both of them might have had a little pig-headedness there. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. He's going back to the rough place. And Jacob didn't go that direction. Now, ain't that funny? Now, there was, he said, I'll meet you over there, but they didn't take the same journey. Different path for every person. The one that's called and the one that's not called. Flesh is going back to the dust from where it came. The spirit's going to return to God who gave it. Guess what the word sucketh means? It means boots. B-O-O-T-H-S. Boots. Do you know what that means to me? According to Scripture, it's the Feast of Tabernacles. Oh, hello. He said, I'm going to Succoth. That's Booths. That's another name for Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Oneness, the Feast of Ingathering. He's saying, hey, it's time for me to go back to Father. I'm going to Tabernacles. I'm going to the third day. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him a house and made booths for his cattle, or his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came to Shalem. What does Shalem mean? Shalem, Shalom in Hebrew. But it's, the word literally means complete, perfection, or peace. And that's what he is. He is the God of peace. A city of Shechem, right? What's that mean? It means the back or the shoulder, and shoulder is symbolic of responsibility, carrying the burden, okay? So he came to peace, into a place of carrying the responsibility. That's what it's showing in his walk. Now he's maturing, very high maturity level coming in. Which is in the land of what? Canaan speaks of what? Low land or humility. So along with this maturity comes what? It comes humility. When he came from Paddan Aram, he came from this place to go to the other place. What does Paddan Aram mean? Well, if you go to the root of the word, it means exalted, the exalted place. So what's he talking about? He was in pride in the exalted place, the high place, and to get there, he had to go back to Canaan, to the low place, to humility. And he pitched his tent before the city. What do you think that city is? Yeah. So what is the city he's talking about right here? What's he talking about? He mentions it right there. He pitched his tent before Shalem, which is peace. Now, he pitched his tent before there. Didn't say he went in the city. He was in front of her, outside of the city yet. Why? He hasn't come to the full maturity yet as the full son to come into the oneness with God. The crucifixion hadn't taken place in the natural, had it? So there's a lot of things going on here, but he had to go back to this place, and he pitched his tent there, waiting. Remember what it says in Hebrews 11? That we're compassed about with so great cloud of witnesses, like a big amphitheater, and they're cheering us on? He came as far as he could go until the crucifixion, until the new covenant came. He went as far as he could go, and there's his place. He's arrived in his place, and now he's got to wait till the rest of the sons come in. Rest of the first fruit's got to be picked. And he bought a parcel of field where he had spread his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor. What's Hamor mean? It's a he-ass or a male ass. Now, donkey. Okay? So he bought it from that. What does a donkey speak of? Well, it speaks of Adam. It speaks of the nature of humanity. We are called the wild-ass nature of man, okay? And it was Shechem's father for 100 pieces of money, and he erected there an altar and called it what? The Mighty One of Israel. God, the Mighty One of Israel, what it should say. So he was putting an altar up, and all this time, and this is something I've noticed in Scripture that I don't hear anybody else mention about it, but my eyes pick it up. Every place in the Bible where something happens with God, what do? They erect an altar, some kind of a monument. Did God ever instruct them to do it? What's he trying to tell you here? You're still trying to worship something other than God. Not the creation, but you're supposed to worship the Creator. Correct? And he's trying to show you, even in all of our honest, sincere thinking, we still go and do things like worshiping that idol. We're making idols. We don't need to worship idols. We have a God who is resident in our lives. Why do I need to worship some external thing when I have an internal God living in me? There's all the worship I need. And the greatest form of worship there is to imitate. Isn't that true? So all I have to do is emulate the Christ that's within me. Let that divine nature that's in my heart be reflected into my lifestyle. There's grace, isn't it? That's the grace of God. That's what he wants us to do. He doesn't want us to build altars. All he's showing you here where they continually build these idols and altars and monuments is they still want to worship something external. That's a carnal, fleshly thought. And the church world has accepted these things as being spiritual things. I have a God in me. You have God in you. So why do I need anything external to worship? Do I? I'm trying to help you here. You don't need to worship anything. You don't need to worship a building. You don't need to worship an organization or a group of people. You worship God. Wasn't that Jesus' command to everybody? Don't worship me, worship God. And yet, who does the church world worship today? Jesus. He said, don't worship me. Worship the Christ, the Spirit in him, not the man. See, they made an idol to him. They make an idol out of everything. And I'm saying, it doesn't say anywhere that God said to make any statues or idols, does it? But religious system has said, that's the way it is. And everybody does it, just like they did there. God didn't tell them. They did it on their own. If God had told them to, and God wanted us to have an idol, don't you think he'd have told us to do it? He told us everything else we had to do. And Jesus made it real clear in the Gospels. He said, man said, what's the greatest of commandments? He said, love the Lord thy God with all your heart, soul, mind, and body, and all the law and all the prophets, whether it's written or unwritten, still hangs on these two things. Love. Love your neighbor and love God. That's it. So he told us everything right there hinges on love. If everything hinges on love, then why do I need a statue? Why do I need a pointy thing on top? Why do I need an image of a cross? Why do I need any of that stuff? See, I have him. Don't you? We all have him because he is the God of the living and the dead.